Open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 15, if you don't mind. I read this text on Sunday afternoon to you. I want to read it again, at least a portion of it, down through verse 8. 1 Corinthians 15, beginning at verse 1. Now I make known to you, brethren, the gospel which I preached to you, which also you received, in which also you stand, and by which also you are saved, if you hold fast the word which I preached to you, unless you believed in vain. For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. After that he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom remain until now, but some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles, and last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared to be to me also. I will confess to you that I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ, for I believe that it is the power of God to salvation to everyone who will believe, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, as Paul said in Romans 1 and verse 16. I know that to the Jews it is a stumbling block, and to Gentiles, and maybe to the intellectuals of our day, it is foolishness, as Paul states in 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 23. But I am still not ashamed. And though it's a simple message, I'll not shrink back from preaching it to you or to anyone else that I have an opportunity to do that with. I firmly believe that the proposition, the following proposition, can be historically verified or proved. If Jesus is the Son of God, then I believe God exists. I believe that we have proved that God exists if we can prove that Jesus is in fact the Son of God. In an earlier lesson, we demonstrated that the New Testament documents are historically accurate documents and that they can be relied on. We spent two nights trying to accomplish that. And I believe that we set forward that pretty clearly, so that we've been able to come away from those first couple of studies on Monday and Tuesday night with a firm confidence that when we read our Bibles, when we read the Gospels especially, or the New Testament, that we are reading an accurate copy of what the original eyewitnesses said they saw in regard to Jesus of Nazareth. What we want to do now is we want to go to those historical records and to try to see what they say about Jesus. Do they prove that he is the Son of God? I have not asked anyone to believe that the Bible is an inspired word of God. I certainly believe that it is. Don't make any mistake about that. But in terms of the purpose of this study, what is only critical up to this point is not that you necessarily believe that the Bible comes to us from God. I think that will become evident eventually to everyone. But what is necessary for the purpose of this study is that you at least believe that the New Testament documents relate accurate historical information to us. So when we go to these historical documents, do they prove that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? That this man from Nazareth was more than just a man, that he was in fact God in the person of Jesus Christ? There's one event in the life of Jesus that gives irrefutable proof that he was more than just a man, that he is in fact the Son of God. And that event, of course, is his resurrection from the dead. I believe that we can prove that this event actually took place in time and space. We've already demonstrated that the documents, the New Testament documents, are historically reliable. Do those documents bear out the idea that Jesus actually rose from the dead? And by rising from the dead, demonstrate that he is the Son of God. To prove it, we will look at these historical documents and we'll see what they say, particularly about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. And primarily tonight, though it's kind of a sad way and sort of a maybe a depressing way to look at things, we're going to tonight simply try to decide whether or not Jesus was actually killed or on the cross, whether or not crucifixion actually killed Jesus. And we're going to look at his burial for a minute, and we're going to find out some things about the circumstance of his burial to see what happened with regard to this tomb in which he was buried in. So the part of 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that we're going to focus on primarily is the part where Paul says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried." We're going to look at those two aspects of the proposition primarily tonight. I want to suggest to you that when Jesus began his public work, he was rather popular with the common people, but he was not so popular with the Jewish religious leaders. They did not like his teaching. They didn't like what he was saying. They didn't like particularly what he was saying about the coming Messiah. And so they, through hook and crook, were able to turn the people against Jesus ultimately. And they finally had him executed on false charges by the Roman government. And Luke, the 23rd chapter, we're taught there about those charges that they were able to accuse Jesus of and get him executed on. And if we look at those and we know anything about the life of Jesus, we know that they are not valid. They began to accuse him, saying, Luke 23 and verse 2, "We have found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." It's interesting to me that as they talk about the fact that Jesus says he is the Christ, a Christ, they then interpret that messianically, correctly, for the purpose of accusing Jesus, because the Christ was a king, or was to be a king, was to be the king, as it were. That's what the Messiah, the Old Testament Messiah, predicted about the Christ. But you can see how these Jews are using that interpretation, or that messianic interpretation of the Christ, to get Jesus in a bad standing with the Roman public, or Roman government, because it now seems that he is posing a threat to the Roman emperor, and that was their whole purpose, because they're trying to get him crucified. Pilate, who was the Roman governor of Judea, he examined Jesus carefully and found no fault with him. But he gave in to the Jewish pressure. Pilate was a man who was in a very difficult situation. He was a man who had not always been impressive to his bosses, those who were higher up, particularly the emperor. He had been a rather cruel man and a rather vicious man, and was not very known for being a very patient man. And he had often put himself by his own political practices into positions that made his position as governor of Judea kind of it was kind of difficult. And of course, he was also tenuous, we might say. He was also, of course, leading a part of the Roman Empire, the Jewish people, who were known for insurrection and for causing problems. And he was charged with the duty of trying, in this very volatile political environment, to try to maintain some kind of peace. And so, even though he could not find any fault in Jesus Christ, because the Jews pressed him on it, he finally gave in to the pressure and delivered Jesus up to be crucified. I'm going to tell you something about crucifixion. It is an awful, awful way to die. We have spent so many years seeing the cross as kind of a symbol of our hero's death, maybe a symbol of our hero, that we have sort of lost the idea maybe of how awful crucifixion was. I find one of the things that's very interesting to me is that sometimes when we talk about the crucifixion, that we tend to want to come and maybe talk about the physical act of it, and we must talk about that because it's horrible. And we talk about the nails being driven in his hands and the cross being raised and dropped into the hole, and imagine the anguish and the pain of that. And yet when you read the New Testament accounts, the Gospels simply say that when they got to Golgotha, there they crucified him. Now, I think that there's a reason why we're not given, a couple reasons maybe why we're not given kind of a graphic description of how awful crucifixion was in those gospel accounts. One is because I think something far greater was happening there than just the physical suffering of Jesus. I will ultimately tell you here that ultimately I believe that what was happening was the penalty was being paid for our sins. And so something bigger than just the physical suffering was happening. But I would like to suggest to you that in the first century, all you had to say was, "There they crucified him." And that would almost certainly provoke a sense of, "Oh, no, not crucifixion." Because crucifixion was known to be an awful, horrible form of execution reserved for only the vilest of criminals. You know that it was illegal to crucify a Roman citizen. You couldn't do that. They weren't allowed to be crucified. That was such a horrible form of death. And that's what they did to Jesus. They savagely beat him almost to a bloody pulp, almost to the point of death, even before they took him to the cross. Then they took him to Golgotha and they crucified him in one of the most shameful ways between two common criminals. Nails were driven in his hands and his feet. There he hung for nearly 9 hours, and there he died. But according to the historical records, Jesus didn't stay dead. The New Testament writers claim that he rose from the dead. To prove that the resurrection actually occurred, we have to first prove that Jesus actually died on the cross. There could be no resurrection if Jesus did not actually die. In fact, one of the more common theories of explaining what we will come to talk about by the end of this lesson, the empty tomb, one of the more common ways in which atheists and agnostics have tried to explain away the empty tomb is by a theory which they call the swoon theory. The swoon theory is that Jesus did not actually die on the cross, that the execution of Jesus was not completed, that he did not actually die, that he simply passed out. And in a fainting, because he was fainted, it was assumed that he was dead, and therefore they put him in the tomb, and later on he revived in the tomb and escaped by some other entrance to the tomb. We're going to find out that that simply is impossible based on the historical evidence that is recorded for us. That the swoon theory simply is not valid. And a part of disproving the swoon theory, a part of proving the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, we have to demonstrate that Jesus actually died. And I'm here to affirm to you this evening that concerning the execution of Jesus, there is one thing about which we can be absolutely sure. And that is that Jesus actually died. I am convinced that the evidence is overwhelming to support the fact that Jesus did not pass out, he did not faint, he did not pretend, he was actually killed when they put him on the Roman cross. And I want you to consider several pieces of information that I believe put this beyond question, that verify the fact that Jesus actually died, that make it clearly a historical fact, something that actually happened. There are several pieces of information that we can put together that put it beyond question. Number one, the method of his execution. We mentioned a moment ago that Jesus was crucified or was executed by means of Roman crucifixion. And I will tell you that Roman crucifixion was something that a person did not survive. I am not aware of any historical evidence of anyone ever surviving crucifixion. In fact, a number of years ago, we investigated this. My friend David and I, David Disselkamp and I, investigated this, consulting one of the professors at Florida College, a man by the name of James Hodges, who's now gone on to his reward. But James Hodges was a noted archaeologist and scholar in this field, and he knew of no historical evidence of anyone ever having survived Roman crucifixion. And so the point is, people weren't crucified, and some of them survived. No one survived this kind of execution. What happens to someone when they are crucified is they are hung by their hands. And if you take someone and suspend their full weight by their arms so that they're not moving up or down, they're just hanging by their arms, what will happen to the body is that the blood will sink rapidly to the lower extremities, and in 6 to 12 minutes, blood pressure drops by 50%. The pulse rate will begin to double, and the heart, because it is deprived of blood, causes one to faint. And that certainly does happen in crucifixion. But as one continues to hang there in that state, what happens is the pressure on the heart becomes so much that the heart collapses due to poor blood circulation or insufficient circulation. And the result is that when someone dies of crucifixion, the method or the mode of death or the cause of death is heart failure. You may not realize that, but that's actually what happens, is ultimately a person dies of heart failure in regard to crucifixion. To prevent this kind of thing happening to a person's body, what the individual who is being executed has to do is to enable him to exhale, one can take air in while hanging by their arms, but must pick themselves up to exhale. So the victim will hold himself up by his legs. And so a person who is crucified with nails in his hands and in his feet will have to push himself up and hold himself up to some degree so that he can take on oxygen, and that will keep things functioning within his body in an appropriate way. But eventually what happens, and sometimes crucifixions lasted for days depending on the stamina of the individual who was being crucified, but eventually what happens is the victim becomes physically exhausted and can no longer hold himself up. And when a victim is to that point where they are hanging only by their hands without being pushed up at all, death comes rather quickly after that. Now, from the gospel accounts, look particularly at Mark's gospel, we learn that Jesus was crucified at the third hour of the day. That would be 9 o'clock in the morning, according to Mark chapter 15, verse 25. He died, according to Mark chapter 15, verses 34 through 37, at the ninth hour of the day. The ninth hour of the day would be the equivalent of our 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And so from 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Jesus' body hangs motionless on the cross. If for some reason he was not dead at 3 o'clock, as the historian Mark suggests he was, and he continued to hang on the cross in that still position for very long, he would certainly have died relatively quickly. The truth of the matter is, we know that he hung on the cross from 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That Mark records that he died at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that his body remained on the cross until evening, which was about 6 p.m., according to Mark 15, verse 42, Luke says, just as the Sabbath day was about to begin, Luke 23 and verse 54. And so the point is that Jesus would have hung motionless on the cross for at least 2 hours, 2 or 3 hours, which is way more than enough time for him to have actually died. And so the point is that based on the historical records, the crucifixion of Jesus lasted sufficiently long enough that he most certainly would have died. And so he was crucified. That method itself ensured the fact that he was going to die. Secondly, though, we're told that his legs were not broken in John the 19th chapter. Now, that may sound strange to you, may not understand what that's about. But if you understand and remember what I said about the need for a victim to push himself up on the cross to exhale air and to keep the blood circulating throughout his body, that sometimes the Romans wanted to hasten the death of some victim for some reason. And so they had a practice then of taking a wooden mallet, a heavy wooden mallet, and they would approach the victim who was hanging,
and they would hit them at the knees and break the legs of those men who are hanging on a cross, or those victims on the cross. Of course, now with one's legs broken, what happens? One cannot continue to push himself up. The result is that death comes very rapidly after that point. Okay? Well, the interesting thing is that the Jews, according to John chapter 19, because the Sabbath day was approaching, and this particular Sabbath was a high Sabbath, in other words, it was a Sabbath that fell within a time of Jewish holiday. They were celebrating, they'd celebrated the Passover. The Passover was the first day of a 7-day festival called the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so that Sabbath was going to be a high Sabbath. So the Jews, because the day, it was the day of the preparation for the Sabbath, so that the bodies would not be remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for that Sabbath was a high day, they asked Pilate that their legs might be broken, that they might be taken away. So the soldiers came, this is John chapter 19, verse 20, 32 now. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first man and of the other who was crucified with him. But coming to Jesus, when they saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. Now let me tell you something. The guys who are inspecting these criminals, Jesus being considered one of these three criminals, the men who are inspecting these criminals are professional executioners. Roman executioners, Roman soldiers knew when people were dead. They walked up to the first man and realized he wasn't dead, and they broke his legs. They walk up to the second man, realize he's not dead, so they break his legs. They walk up to Jesus, and they determine it is unnecessary to break his legs because he is already dead. A Roman executioner would have known that he was dead. But just to make certain, the one who makes this historical record, John, tells us that he saw with his own eyes a soldier come and pierce Jesus with a sword, with a spear. Verse 34, but one of the soldiers pierced his side with a spear, and immediately blood and water came out. And he who has seen has testified, and his testimony is true, and he knows that he's telling the truth, so that you also may believe. So John says, they came and inspected the body of Jesus, determined he was already dead, did not need to break his legs. But just to ensure that no mistake was made, again, a Roman soldier, not you, not me, a Roman soldier comes up and sticks his spear in the side of Jesus. Now, let me tell you something. When a Roman soldier sticks his spear in you, you die. Okay? Those guys know how to stick a spear in someone so that it kills them. And this Roman professional soldier spears Jesus, sticks Jesus in the side with a spear just to ensure that he was dead. But there's one other thing here that is mentioned that's interesting to me. John says that he witnessed that from the wound where this man had pierced his side, that there came out blood and water. Folks, that is medical confirmation that that Jesus was actually dead. Blood and bodily fluids had already begun to collect in his abdomen, and they came out of this wound, and that was medical confirmation that he was dead. Now, I'll just throw this out to you. Last couple years, I was teaching a man. I think I told you about him. He's a surgeon. He used to work at OSF, and now has been finishing up his degree out in Albany, New York. A young man by the name of Dr. Brandon Keyes. I was trying to convince him, and fortunately we were able to with this information. He ultimately became a believer and is now a Christian. But Brandon was a doctor. He didn't buck at this point, not one bit. When I made this particular point about the medical confirmation, I was wondering what his reaction would be, and he concurred that that was evidence that Jesus was already dead. Doctor, modern doctor telling us that. And so that says
that even before they pierced his side, he was already dead because blood and water came forth from the wound. We're also told that Pilate had the initial reports of Jesus' death confirmed by the centurion who supervised the execution. In Mark the 15th chapter, Joseph of Arimathea comes to Pilate and he requests the body of Jesus for burial. And Pilate, in verse 44, wondered, this is Mark 15 and verse 44, Pilate wondered if he was dead by this time, and summoning the centurion, he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And ascertaining this from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. So I want you to notice that we've gone through all these things to confirm the death of Jesus. Even Pilate confirms the death of Jesus by questioning the centurion in charge of the execution squad and having ascertained from that executioner that Jesus was most certainly dead. He then releases the body of Jesus to Joseph of Arimathea for burial. In fact, though, he doesn't release the body of Jesus. Interestingly enough, the word that is used in this particular text, though it's translated in English by the word body, is not the word toma, which is the word for body in Greek language, but actually ptoma, which is the word for corpse. He releases the dead body to Joseph of Arimathea for burial. With these many historical facts presented, there can be absolutely no reasonable doubt that Jesus actually died. I'm here tonight to tell you that the historical record is clear that Jesus did not survive his crucifixion. He was actually and really dead. And so that brings us to another important aspect of things. We want to talk a little bit about the burial of Jesus. Paul says not only that did Christ die, according to the scriptures, but that he was buried. I would suggest to you that the historical record tells us that Joseph of Arimathea, a wealthy disciple, arranged to have Jesus buried. We talked about that from Mark the 15th chapter, beginning at verse 42. It is Joseph of Arimathea who comes and asks for the body of Jesus. In fact, the same thing is taught or is revealed in John's Gospel as well, John the 19th chapter. And John tells us, in John's Gospel, he tells us that Joseph of Arimathea was assisted in burying Jesus by a man named Nicodemus, who was a Jewish ruler himself. In fact, the very same Jewish ruler who had come to Jesus by night in John the 3rd chapter. So in John 19 and verse 39, we're told that Nicodemus, who had first come to him by night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes about 100 pounds weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloth, wrappings with spices, as is the custom of the Jews. Now there in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. Therefore, because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was nearby, they laid Jesus there. So Joseph of Arimathea is the person who, aided by Nicodemus, buries Jesus the day he is crucified, just before the breaking of the Sabbath day, or the Sabbath day coming. The tomb in which Jesus was buried, we learn from the gospel accounts, was actually owned by Joseph of Arimathea. It was located in a garden near the place where Jesus was crucified. We're told in these texts that it was a new tomb. We read that in John 19 and verse 41. And it's important to note that the text tells us that it was a new tomb. The reason that that's important for you and me, we don't understand it, but it's important for first century people to know that. It's important for us to know that. Because in the first century, it was common practice to have kind of a family tomb. And especially tombs like this one, which were cut into solid rock. Sometimes they made tombs in caves. You remember there was a famous Old Testament character who purchased a cave for the burial of his wife. And he ultimately was buried there, and some of his descendants were buried there. Remember who that was? Abraham. Abraham, who purchased the cave of Machpelah to bury Sarah, his wife.
Ultimately, he was buried there, and then some of his descendants were buried there. But that was typical. They would take a cave, or in this case, we'll find it's a tomb that's cut into solid rock, and they would make shelves in the walls of the tomb, and they would lay Aunt Susie here and Uncle Tom there, and Mom here and Dad here, you know, and they would have a number of family members buried in this tomb. Well, the reason it's important to notice that is because we'll see in just a moment. In this instance, what I want you to know right at this point, though, is that this is a new tomb. A new tomb in which nobody had yet been laid. So Jesus' body was the first body ever buried in this tomb. It was a brand new tomb. Notice also that this tomb was cut into solid rock. If we go back to Mark the 15th chapter and verse 46, you could also look at Luke's account. But Joseph brought a linen cloth and took him down and wrapped him in the linen cloth and laid him in a tomb which had been hewed out in the rock, and he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. So this was a fancy tomb, okay? It wasn't a cave. It was a tomb that had actually been cut into the rock. So they actually had a solid piece of rock here, a solid mountain portion here, and they'd actually cut into this solid rock with men who were able to do stone cutters and that sort of thing, were able to dig out this room for a tomb, and that's the tomb in which Jesus was laid. We also know that extreme measures were taken to guarantee that the body of Jesus stayed in the tomb. The Jews did not want the body stolen. And so we're told that the tomb's door was covered with a large stone. If you go to Matthew, the 27th chapter, we're kind of looking at various parts of just picking out parts of the various accounts of the life of Christ to gather all of the facts concerning the tomb. We're told in Matthew chapter 27 and in verse 60 that he was laid into this new tomb which had been hewn out in the rock, and Joseph rolled this large stone against the entrance of the tomb and went away. Well, the tomb, the stone, we're going to find out in just a minute, was actually sealed. Beginning in verse 62, now on the next day, the day after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together with Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember that when he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I am to rise again.' Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He has risen from the dead,' and the last deception will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard. Go and make it secure as you know how." And they went and made the grave secure along with the guard, and they set a seal on the stone. So they sealed this, they put this large stone in front of the door, and they sealed it with this, and to ensure the security, the Jews insisted that Pilate post a guard of soldiers. A Roman guard of soldiers usually consisted of 4 soldiers, that was typical, and so most likely 4 Roman soldiers were posted by the tomb, as Matthew suggests, to make certain that none of the disciples came and stole the body out of the tomb. So here's this tomb cut into solid rock, not a cave, so there are not other entrances to this place. There's one entrance. That entrance has a big stone placed in front of it. It's sealed, and guards are posted to ensure that the body of Jesus stays in the tomb at least after the third day. Interestingly enough, despite all of these facts, the historical record shows that on the third day after Jesus' death, his tomb turned up empty. Despite everything that they had done to ensure that Jesus stayed in the grave, somehow his tomb turned up empty. The first one to see the tomb empty were the women who had followed. If you go to Luke's account,
You'll notice in Luke chapter 23 that there are these women who have been following Jesus, and they're very concerned about him. And after he is crucified, we're told that that verse 55 of Luke 23, now the women who had come with him out of Galilee and followed, and they saw the tomb and how the body was laid. They then returned and prepared spices and perfumes, and on the Sabbath day they rested according to the commandment. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they came to the tomb, bringing spices which they prepared, and they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they entered, they did not find the body of Jesus. So the first ones to see the tomb empty was this woman, and particularly one woman is kind of zeroed in on in John's account. It's Mary Magdalene. And when she sees the tomb empty, she runs, verse 2 of John 20, verse 2, she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved and said to them, they have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him. So Peter and the other disciples went forth, and they were going to the tomb. The two of them were running together, and the other disciple ran ahead faster than Peter and came to the tomb first. And stooping and looking in, he saw the linen wrappings lying there, but he did not go in. And so Simon Peter also came, following him, and entered the tomb. And he saw the linen wrappings lying there, and the face cloth, which had been on his head, not lying with the linen wrappings, but rolled up in a place by itself. So the other disciple who had first come to the tomb, then he also entered, and he saw and believed. So what happens is, when the women come and they find the tomb empty, Mary runs, hightails it back to the apostles, and she says, they've taken away the body of the Lord, don't know where it is. And so the second ones to see the empty tomb were Peter and John. Peter and John start running toward the tomb. Evidently, John was in better shape than Peter or something, maybe younger, I don't know. But he gets ahead of Peter, and he gets to the tomb, and when he gets there, he stoops over and he looks into the tomb, but he does not venture in. Peter, of course, being the impetuous one, we're not surprised by it. When he finally gets to the tomb, he just rushes right on in. And I want you to notice the careful examination of the tomb that is made. These guys didn't come in and take a glance around and leave. These guys inspected the tomb very carefully. You will notice that the inspection revealed some fine details. It revealed, first of all, that they saw linen wrappings in which his body was wrapped. They saw those in one place, and they saw the face cloth that had covered his head folded up or rolled up and sitting off on another place by itself. That they noted such fine details proves that in their excitement, they did not overlook the body of Jesus. Some would have us to believe that, yes, they ran into the tomb and they kind of took a quick look, and they were so excited that they just kind of, and had that idea planted in their mind by those women, that maybe the body was gone. And so they maybe just kind of looked quickly and left and overlooked the body. Oh, it was right over there. They just didn't see it over there. No, the historical evidence here is that they took a real good look in there. They took such a good look in there that they saw the linen wrappings and the face cloth off by itself in another place. How do we explain the empty tomb? There was no escaping by some other exit. First of all, there was no escaping because he was dead. He was clearly dead when he was put in the tomb. Well, he couldn't have escaped, though, by some other exit. Why couldn't that have happened? Because, simply because, there were no other exits. This was a tomb that had been cut into solid rock. Had it been a cave, yeah, you know how caves might have alternate entrances. But this was not a cave.
This was a tomb cut into solid rock. There was one way in and one way out, and that was it. The body wasn't confused with other bodies in the tomb. How do we know that? Because it was a new tomb. A new tomb in which no other body had ever been buried before. Jesus' body had been the only body placed in that tomb. It wasn't there. His disciples didn't steal it. And we know that is the case because the stone on the tomb was sealed and the tomb was guarded by soldiers. And I don't know if you understand this or not, but soldiers, Roman soldiers particularly, true also of Jewish soldiers, by the way. You remember the story of Herod when they had Peter imprisoned in Acts, the 12th chapter, and he is able to escape. You know what they did to those Jewish soldiers who were guarding Peter and let him escape? Herod had him executed. Same thing would happen to Romans. You remember in Acts the 16th chapter, the Roman centurion thought that all of his prisoners had escaped. You know what he was about to do? Kill himself. It's the only honorable thing for a Roman soldier to do, because at least die by my own hand than die by execution in shame for having let my charge escape. The disciples couldn't have stolen it. The stone was sealed and the tomb was guarded. Folks, the empty tomb has to be explained. And it has to be explained in such a way that it's consistent with all the historical facts that are presented. The only adequate explanation that objectively considers all the facts is simply this: the tomb was empty because Jesus raised from the dead. That is how his disciples explained the empty tomb. They said it was empty because God raised him from the dead, and they claimed to have witnessed him being alive again after he died. And we saw this passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 is one of several in which appearances are claimed to have been made by Jesus to various individuals after his death and burial, once he was raised from the dead. For now, for tonight, we're going to leave you with the empty tomb. If you reject the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, you'll have to find a way to explain Jesus' tomb, why it turned up empty. You can't ignore it. In our lesson, next lesson, we'll try to consider some explanation, or explanation given by the New Testament writers. We will listen to what they said, and we will try to determine if their testimony is believable. But right now, you got to wrestle with this issue of how do you explain the empty tomb. There is no doubt that Jesus clearly died by execution on a Roman cross. And there is no doubt that once his body had been buried, somehow the third day that tomb turned up empty. You have to be able to explain that. I mentioned that I've used this material with other people and used this type of argumentation with atheists and agnostics. I sat down with Carl Ballard several years after he obeyed the gospel. One time we got back to the United States and were visiting with Carl. He was one of those guys that we had used this on. He'd been an atheist and he had become a Christian and is now preaching, still to this day, preaching in Brazil, doing a lot of great work in the kingdom of God. I asked Carl, I said, why was it? What made the difference? Why did you become a believer? And he told me, I simply couldn't get away. I couldn't deal with the question of the empty tomb and the resurrection of Jesus. There was no logical explanation for that except the one given by the apostles. And yes, I recognize, guys, I recognize that accepting the explanation of the apostles
and the eyewitnesses that Jesus raised from the dead, that requires us to believe a miracle occurred. I recognize that. And I recognize that it's very difficult to accept the idea of a miracle. But if we are going to be honest and have not already prejudicially dismissed the idea of God, then we have to allow that that might be a possibility. You see, because if there is a God, and if that God was wanting to communicate to human beings, we would expect him to do something just like this to prove he's there. And so, yes, ultimately, we're asking you to believe in a miracle. But the question is, does the evidence support that? Well, you got to deal with this empty tomb thing. You got to find a way. If you reject the resurrection, you got to find a way to naturally explain with all of the evidence how that tomb got empty. Good luck with that, man. People have been trying to do that for years, and they haven't been able to do it.